Welcome.
This is Hope. On this episode of According to Your Purpose, we have Ron Dart. Ron is an associate professor at the University of Fraser Valley in British Columbia, where he teaches about religion and politics. In this episode, we got to talk about Thomas Merton, Jordan Peterson, and the importance of stories. We did have a little bit of issue during the recording of this episode, so we recorded it over Zoom, but I hope you guys will stick with it because it's an awesome conversation. Here's my talk with Ron. Ron, I appreciate you coming on the show. This is very exciting for me. I have to tell you, I have not been this excited prepping for a show in a long time. I think in a lot of ways that we are kindred spirits. Your book on the Beatitudes sent me down a few rabbit holes. I became aware of your work because of the book that you edited on Jordan Peterson, and I read your piece that you contributed to that book. But kind of diving more in, I was like, this guy's really interesting. You have the mountaineering, you know, and there's not a lot of Christians that are talking about silence and meditation and contemplative worldviews and all this sort of stuff. So I guess just to start, how did you get into this?
Well, when I was growing up in the 60s, I spent time in Berkeley. And I think I'd always felt a certain dis-ease or unease with the frantic lifestyle that people were leading, their inability to stop, to slow down, and then identifying their identity by what they've consumed, produced, done, worth being evaluated by these very superficial criteria. And my question always was, is that all I am as a being that Evelyn Underhill, a great Anglican mystic, talks about? We spend too much time conjugating three verbs to want, to have, and to do, and we don't know how to be. And from the time I was in my teens, those were questions that pressed in on me, they evoked in me, they called forth from me. What does it mean to be? And being in contemplation, in solitude, and silence, they're all part of a family. And so when I was in Berkeley in the late 1960s, there was very much in sort of a post-Christendom civilization, a post-Christian world, there's inevitably the longing for meaning, for purpose. And so what was happening, of course, you have these alternate spiritualities, alternate contemplative traditions, whether from the East or Jewish, Hasidic, Kabbalistic, Muslim, Sufi, various forms of Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikh tradition. They were all attempting to answer the question of what it means to be and who am I back of all my busyness, my franticness, my productivity, which is itself a drug. It's a drug we take regularly to give us a sense of meaning and purpose. But when we detoxify from that busy life, then the question is, who am I? And people don't know what to do with their solitude, their stillness, their quietness. So then they return to busyness again. And so we think we're free, but we become victims of our own drivenness. And this is the great illusion that we're free, but we're just hyper-socialized by a culture of excessive busyness. So I would say from my teens, those were questions I asked. And then there were women and men who were asking those same questions, wiser than I, further down the trail than I. And obviously, Thomas Merton be one of many, many Christians. And I came to see that, in fact, at the heart and the core of the Christian tradition was, in fact, the contemplative way, the way of meditation, the way of stillness, of listening to something deeper within. And so it took me on a search. And of course, that tends to be a little foreign to the Protestant form of Christianity, which banished, marginalized the contemplative, the meditative way. And so part of recovering the depths of Christianity is recovering the contemplative way. And so over the last 40, 50 years, that's been central to my own vocational journey. That's just a sort of a short, abridged Reader's Digest version of it.
I have to imagine that that was not common at Berkeley in the 1960s. That's kind of the opposite of everything happening there in that moment.
Well, there were the two wings of Berkeley in the 60s. There was the hyper activism, the politics, the street protests, the students out opposing Vietnam, the civil rights movement, ecological issues were front and center. Many other very important hot button issues in the culture wars in the 60s, early 70s. But there was also the spirituality journey, the meditative journey, the counterculture. There were two forms of counterculturalism in the 60s. There one was very much the quest for a deeper spirituality in a post-Christendom, post-Christian world. But there was also the many injustices that were being seen at the time, and hence the student activism, both on campus and in larger parts of the United States at the time. So there were two countercultural tendencies, one the spirituality and one the political activism. What eventually was occurring was the people in activism found they were burning themselves out. And so they became interested in spirituality as a way of slowing down, an antidote to a hyper-drivenness, even if it was seemingly good things, but there were deeper demons at work in the drivenness. The people in spirituality, whether it was Buddhist meditative techniques or various forms of Hinduism, the question for them was, well, what does spirituality look like in the public square and public responsibility? So there was this integrating, converging going on in the 60s, which has, I think, matured much more since then. But it was divided at that time. But there was also women and men at the forefront, of which Thomas Merton would be a classic example. But there were many like Merton who were trying to integrate contemplation and action.
So at the beginning of your Beatitudes book, you have, it's quick, it's in the preface, I believe, that you talk about both Merton and Jack Kerouac. Mm-hmm. And that sent me down a rabbit hole that I was so unfamiliar with their stories. I knew of Merton. I had read some of his thoughts on contemplation and all that sort of stuff, but I was less than familiar with his actual story. For my audience who is unfamiliar with those stories, could you share some of the journey between Kerouac and Merton, maybe individually, and then kind of, I guess, how they intersected towards the ends of their lives?
Yeah. So Jack Kerouac, interesting enough, where I live in the British Columbia and Canada, in the Canadian Cascade Mountains, many of these early beats, like Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, Philip Whalen, Kenneth Rexroth, they were all lookouts here in the mountain of the Cascades, the American Cascades, of which then finds its way into the Canadian Cascades. I just lived down the road from Ross Lake, where their lookouts were. Kerouac was in Desolation. I got four of his books come out of his time up in Desolation Lookout. Just down Ross Lake was Gary Snyder, Whalen, Sourdough Lookout, and Salk, and Rexroth. So these are one of the things about the beats, of which Kerouac is a very significant figure, is the theme of lookout could be a triple. It had triple meaning for them. One was, at a very literal sense, looking out for fires, because in the mountains in the summer, things can get very, very dry. Fires erupt, and you need people on the lookout for them. That was the literal side. The deeper side was looking out for what's going on in the inner life. And so, again, when a person lives in a lookout for 2 months, there's nobody up there. There's no distractions, no diversions. And so then who am I when all my distractions, my diversions, my busyness is taken away? So it was the looking out for the nature of the what Hopkins would call the inscape. And then there was then looking out into the larger political, social, economic issues. What's happening in America here in the 50s, post-World War II? And the so the triple levels of the lookout. In that sense, Merton saw in Kerouac and the Beats people that were asking questions about the hyper-drivenness of post-World War II America, and the sort of the death of the salesman, as it were, the Willie Loman who works, and then dies of a heart attack at 50, in the name of accomplishing, having things, more toys, a bigger house, expensive vacations, and then he burns himself out as a young person. So Merton and the Beats shared this countercultural contemplative element. Kerouac grew up Catholic, French Catholic in Canada, but the contemplative element in the Roman Catholic Church was marginalized at that time. That's what Merton discovered it well. I mean, became a Cistercian. thinking that he'd finished his MA at Columbia and William Blake, and he was about to start a PhD on Gerard Manley Hopkins. But he recognized in himself this unhealthy drivenness, so he thought the monastic way was where one could find historically, particularly the Cistercians, the contemplative way. But he discovered in the monastery, they were busier with its seven divine offices and making wine and cheese and guests than New York at rush hour. And so it led Merton on a quest to say, is there a Roman Catholic contemplative tradition? This was the same question Kerouac was asking. So his attempt, he never went as deep, obviously, as Merton, and Kerouac never really dealt with his frantic internal drivenness, this on the road, this busy, busy, and sadly so, his end was, you know, he turned to drink and died as a fairly young man. But what they shared intellectually was a longing for the contemplative, a longing to slow down, to be still. Merton obviously understood that in a way Kerouac never did. But what they both shared was this longing for the contemplative. They were restless with the vita activa, restless with the sense of their own busyness, internal and external. And they knew something was missing in the West, because it was missing in their own souls. And so out of that began a search. Some turned to the Christian contemplative tradition, because within historic Christianity, the contemplative is always the roots from which the tree of the soul grows, and from there the fruit of the active emerges. But what happens is, in the West in the last 500 years, with the coming to be of Protestant Christianity, those roots have been cut out, and the active essentially is what defines what it means. And so the problem is, when people have no roots, then the fruit produced is pretty shallow in terms of identity. And so the Beats, of which, and I've done two or three books on, I've done Merton and the Beats of the North Cascades, Merton and the Counterculture, in which I bring in significant Beat writers, and I've done a few other books on Merton. But what they share was a longing at the deepest level for the contemplative, and underlying the need for the contemplative was the question, who am I?
So I was totally unaware of Kerouac's Christian, upbringing. I had a quote here. It was Ted Berrigan was interviewing Kerouac for the Paris Review in 1968, and Ted Berrigan asked him, "How come you never write about Jesus?" And Kerouac replied, "I've never written about Jesus. You're an insane phony. All I write about is Jesus." What's so fascinating to me about Kerouac and Merton is that they're almost mirror images of each other. And what's so fascinating about it is, it almost feels like the two kind of options for the seeking individual. And there's a lot of talk now about young people. The young people, they feel very much that, you know, religion is dead. And you hear about, like, the death of Christianity, the death of all these different religions. But what I see is a lot of seekers. You see astrology on the rise. You see a lot of people identifying as quote unquote spiritual. You see books about, like, positive thinking, all this sort of stuff. And what it is, in my mind, it's people trying to make sense of chaos. They're looking for something transcendent that can root them. And Kerouac and Merton are kind of both the same individual, and one treats their desires with solitude and God, and the other one has that desire but can't seem to escape his carnal desire for drinking and drugs and wildness. What do you think was the difference between them in terms of their ability to get to that higher plane of existence, to be with God? Why was Merton able to do that, but Kerouac unable to do that?
I think underneath Kerouac was this hyper-individualism. With Merton, he committed himself to a community in which he was held responsible and accountable to. Merton could have gone the same path as Kerouac. They had similar, undealt with, erratic tendencies. Kerouac did not have, as it were, a spiritual mentor. he longed for the depth. He knew that he was out of control in terms of indulgent desires and longings. He knew that was a dead end, a cul-de-sac. But he never immersed himself in a community in which he would be befriended, accountable, responsible to others, to walk with him on the journey and say, be careful of indulging this desire. Be careful of pandering to this appetite. There'd be dragons there. Merton, as a monk, and you don't obviously have to become a monk, he chose that Cistercian direction. One can immerse oneself in a parish in the historic sense, or a church, or another community. But in communities, certainly in a monastic context, and in the best of a parochial context, there's women and men who are there who walk side by side with people when they have to face their demons, when they have to face their addictions, when they don't want to go to places, and yet they have to become a deeper, a more mature human being. So I think the big difference would be Kerouac, there was an extreme individualism to him that shied away from meaningful community. He would glance off friends. He would be on the road. He would be with Cassidy, or he would be with a whole range of people. Whereas Merton, for all of his adult life, even though he was restless there at times, it was frustrating for him at times, he knew that was the place where he would be shaped and formed into a deeper, more mature, contemplative human being. Kerouac didn't want to go that direction. He almost went crazy in his time up here at Desolation Lookout. And when he came down, his On the Road had been published, and it was, in one sense, it was a slow deterioration of his soul. And he was a profoundly sensitive introvert, Kerouac was, as was Merton in many ways. But I think one of the big differences, the relationship between the individual seeker and what's the relationship of that to community. And the best of the contemplative meditation, you get a lot of people who will say, I'm spiritual, but not religious. Well, that just becomes a new religion in that sense. But it is religion or community. At religion, we just get the Latin word religio from legament. It is religion that gives us the connection, the ligaments that holds our lives together with others in an integrated, mature way. And Merton understood that in his decades-long life at Gethsemane in Kentucky, which doesn't mean he didn't kick against it, which didn't mean he didn't have problems, he didn't have dust-ups with his abbot and other fellow monks. But it's in that collision with other people that, in fact, we learn charity, we learn love, and we face our own drivenness, our own demons, our own reactionary tendencies. And so community or religion is a very healthy anvil in which our soul is shaped to learn the meaning of love and being integrated into a larger community of life itself. So I think that's why, in that sense, Kerouac's ending was tragic. Merton's was not tragic in the same sad, painful way that Kerouac's was. Merton started a book of poetry called Monk's Pond that Kerouac wrote some lovely poems in, and you get the tenderness. Both explored the issue of Buddhism and Christianity, and it was the contemplative thing they were after. Merton internalized it in the context of community in a way Kerouac never did. For Kerouac, it was an idea, but it was never personally integrated. And it was also not integrated in the context of community. And I think that's why Merton brings a much more mature understanding of the contemplative community, solitude, silence, in a way that Kerouac can be a bit of a distraction in that sense, although a very sensitive and tender distraction. And I mean, I can't help but feeling sorry for what Kerouac could have been, you know, if he was in community.
That was my takeaway as well. I felt a lot of kindredness towards Kerouac. For my generation, are you familiar with Chris McCandless of Into the Wild fame?
Yeah.
that was kind of my hero in high school. I thought, you know, it was the Kerouac of my time. Like, that sounds amazing. A life on the road, you know, just tramping around and just getting to meet people and experience America. That was like the ideal. You know, I was into music at the time. And so the idea of just being like out and about and getting to experience life was very attractive to me. But McCandless, strangely enough, kind of comes to the conclusion of Merton in the sense that his, you know, if you are familiar with this whole story, he ends up accidentally starving himself to death because he eats a poisonous plant. But his last message was, love is only real when shared. That's the last thing he writes before he passes away. And it's almost, it's a heartbreaking thing because Kerouac was his idol. And he came to the same conclusion that Merton did in the end, ultimately. What was so interesting about this, it was kind of like a weird little God wink thing. So this morning I was walking and I was listening. Are you familiar with Stephen Pressfield? He writes Legend of Bagger Vance. He's a novel writer. He also writes these books kind of about the creative journey and how to be a creative. And it's like in these encouraging books about making things for people. And I'm listening to his book, How to Be a Pro. And he actually just by chance brought up Kerouac. He put artists into two buckets. He says an artist is either a professional or an amateur. And he equated amateurs to addicts, that they couldn't discipline themselves enough to stay away from either drinking or drugs, but more commonly, social media or reading the news or whatever it may be. But what's interesting is that he, without even bringing in the Merton element, he basically tagged amateurs as somebody that gives in to the temptation of whatever they want, while the professional had the ability to sit in silence. It seems like silence is the thing that we are so lacking, but we can't seem to turn the corner as a society. It's like, you know, kind of what you were speaking to, I think with social media, you have, you know, we're getting these dopamine hits and it makes us want more, but what we really want is community. We get on there because we have a desire for community, but we can't ever get there. What do you think that we need to do as a society or as a church or as Christians to help people get there? Because it almost feels like it has to be an internal journey in some sense.
Well, yes, it's always an internal and an external journey. It's what Hopkins calls, I even mentioned my Beatitudes, the inscape and the landscape. So our inner life only becomes enriched and deepened and matures to the tent, to the extreme, we're knit together with others. And that's what community is about. And so you have pseudo communities on various forms of texting and all of these other ways of interacting with others. But that's not real community. It's vicarious community. Real community is when you deal with real flesh and blood people locally. This is why one of the first disciplines of Benedict, for example, is stability. You're stable in one place. You stay with people who you interact with in their phases and journeys of life, from what's called the hatch match to dispatch, or the, you know, you're born hatching, you're matching, you enter into a relationship, you dispatch with death. But you, this whole, the multiple seasons, as Shakespeare would say, you know, all the world's a stage, men and women merely players, we go through seasons in life. Now it's tragic when people do that individually, or they do it vicariously through machines, you know, and there's various types of interacting. And sadly, so cancel culture comes out of this, and the cult, you know, the culture wars itself, where we don't listen to one another. And but actually being with real people, flesh and blood people, over a long journey and living through various phases and seasons from a deep contemplative way, that's a very different understanding of community. So people long for it, but the price you have to pay for it demands something of the ego. It demands something of a narcissistic tendencies. And I mean, people could come to see external things as the addiction, but the real addiction is to the ego, what Alan Watts called the skin encapsulated ego. And that's what really has to be faced into the, because the ego is this ravenous emptiness that as soon as you get what you want, then you want something else. So I, you know, have a gold, if I get this degree or in this vocation or have this toy to play with. But then as soon as anyone gets what they want, then they're hungry for something else again, because it's a great emptiness that can never, and that's the ego. It always consumes. And so deeper than that, and this is why contemplation is so important, is that we begin to ask ourselves, who is this thing I call myself, which is lusting again and again for experiences, relationships, toys, traveling, busyness, inability to be still? Is that who I am? And if that's all a person is, that's pretty shallow and pretty thin. But we all know there's depths to people that go far more substantive than that superficial, egoistic, narcissistic self. And that's what contemplation invites us to. It says, be still, slow down. And then who are we in the stillness? And so we often keep procrastinating the contemplative, the meditative, the spirit. Oh, when I get this done, or when I accomplish this, or when I have this toy or this amusement, then I'll slow down. But as soon as, of course, we're called to slow down, then we find something busy to do again, because that's the nature of the ego, cannot be still. And so it itself is, if we're not careful, we define ourselves by that. And then we're perpetually restless, because that cannot fulfill us. And this is where contemplation is, slow down, be still. How do we live with solitude and silence in the context of community? And community is very, very important, because it's friends. And the best, this is why we call philosophy philia sophia, is just friends in search of wisdom. And at the heart of wisdom in classical thought is the contemplative. This is why for Aristotle, for example, in his Nicomachean Ethics, you go through the virtues, the vices, or the false self, the true self, then friendships, book 8 and 9, and book 10 is contemplation. And so these are all, I mean, the classical tradition of Christianity, at the center of it is contemplation. And it's knowing the self. This is where Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. So the question is, who is the self? This uber-driven thing that's been socialized and conditioned by post-World War II drivenness? Or is there something more? And the most sensitive souls are the ones who are asking those deeper, much more deeper questions, which contemplation is a portal into answering that. But sadly so, it's been banished, marginalized by elements of the church and society. But there's always these countercultural types that say, no, this is where home is. This is where my home of the soul is. This is where rest and quietness is. You know, Latin, it's quies or silento. And if I'm ever going to be at home with myself, I have to go to those places with friends that take me to a much deeper understanding of wisdom and insight.
Why do you think confronting the ego reveals the wholeness of self? Why does the ego not want the wholeness of self?
It's an imperial. There's something very imperialistic about the ego that insists its needs be met, its ravenous hunger be met, whether we use people, whether we use objective things, whether it's possessions or property. It colonizes all parts of who we are. And that's where Jesus, well, any great spiritual director says the first step of growth is dying. You have to die. What you're dying to is not your real self. You're dying to the ego. It's the little self which inflates itself. So this is, I mean, in the Christian tradition of the Eucharist, you have the two main symbols in which the presence of Christ emerges is the wine and the bread. And of course, a grape begins as a little seed, which is like the ego. The danger is to think that little seed is reality, but that little seed has to die. As it breaks open its skin, it becomes a grape. Then the grape has to be crushed as well to produce the wine, and the wine itself has to mellow. And so this process of what Christians would call deification or transformation is the process of many deaths to the ego, which is just really a small little thing that we assume is our real self. And all spiritual teachers argue that death to what we are not is the foundation to the resurrection phoenix, like of who it's like in Harry Potter, for example, the major metaphor is the phoenix, mm-hmm. you know, and there's a reason for that. It's really just drawing from the Christian tradition of death and resurrection. The same with the bread. It's, you know, a little seed has to break through its skin, breaks through its skin, but it has to be crushed as it becomes grain. Now to that becomes the loaf, which is, of course, the loaf and the chalice of wine or the Holy Grail. In that sense, this is a unity of multiple grapes and multiple pieces. And so here you're into community again, you know, and this is the resurrection of ourself is done in the context of community. And so, but we cling so tenaciously to what we think we are, only to realize that who we think we are, in fact, is the false self, and that has to die so that actually who we really are will be born. Do you know the story of the oak tree and the acorn?
I do not. I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have this great oak tree and all these little acorns have fallen to the ground and they feel so frustrated because their little shells have been bruised and their little caps are tilted off, not right. And they go to massage therapy, as it were, into counseling to sort of heal their little shell and the little acorn. And they get group sessions where they're together and they just feel so hurt that, in fact, you know, they've fallen from the tree. And all of a sudden, coming out of nowhere is this little acorn, probably thrown out of the mouth of a bird, and its little cap has fallen off and its skin is cracked and open. And they gather around it and they say, what we can do to heal you, and here's therapy, and here's, you know, here's a hot tub for you, and here's a counselor, and all sorts of ways that they can keep this, what they see, terribly damaged and bruised acorn. And the little acorn, and this is like, you know, trying to protect our little ego, and the bruised little acorn looks up at the oak tree and he says, how do you think that oak tree became an oak? Well, it had to die to the little acorn. And it's like the ego. It's a little acorn. We tend to protect it. We polish it. We want to take care of it. And if we're feeling uneasy, we go to a counselor, a massage therapist. And there's multiple means we use to protect this little ego. Or is the heart of spirituality, it's you got to die, because that's just a little wee world. And then out of that, we become the oak tree of our new being. And of course, that's what good spirituality is about, is dying to who we think we are so we may resurrect phoenix-like in terms of the oak tree.
It actually sounds a lot to me like a lot of the Carl Jung stuff that Jordan Peterson talks about. The way that he interprets the Bible is very thematic, and it's about the hero's journey. He's almost like a Christian Joseph Campbell, if you will, or something.
Yeah, very, very much. Peterson, as you mentioned, he has many sources he draws from, but one is Carl Jung. But underlying, you know, when Peterson turns to, say, the Bible or Genesis, he's hoping to do something on Exodus as well, the second book in the Hebrew canon, is that he rightly so understands that within these stories, because myths, I mean, some people get thrown off when he uses myth. Myth is just an eternal, it's eternal truth wrapped in the garments of a story. That's all myth is. And some people go after him, well, you know, is this historically true? Or can we find Noah's Ark? Or, you know, is it 6 days of young earth creation? For Peterson, that's irrelevant. His question, what are the stories that speak to us across time, of which myth is a significant conveyor of insight? And so, obviously, Joseph Campbell was doing that, you know, a few decades ago. Peterson is doing that today. So drawing from biblical myths, drawing from other religious myths, drawing from Walt Disney myths, and there's a variety of myths. But underneath myth is the notion there's a structure. Our notion of freedom is a byproduct of understanding that structure. We sometimes think freedom and structure are at odds with one another. Myth tells us essentially that the foundation of all freedom is understanding the order, the structure of things. And so we know, for example, we don't say, I'm going to use my freedom to go outside and drive on the other side of the road, and everyone can use their freedom to do that. No, we know there's an order. Everyone stays in the right side if they're going to go one way or the other. And then you have freedom, the freedom of, you know, the road to drive. We don't say I can use my freedom to put my hand on a hot burner. Well, you can do that if you want, but you're not going to have a healthy hand. There's a structure of things the body can do and not do. If you say, I'm not going to eat for a month, well, a person has a freedom to do that, but then they don't have the freedom to be healthy. You know, or I'm not going to sleep for 6 weeks. Well, a person has the freedom to do that, but then they don't have the freedom to be alive very well. So the freedom is always the product of understanding the order, the legitimate order of things, or the structure of things. And myth is all about that. It's whether it's Lord of the Rings or C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia or Space Trilogy or Tolkien's work or Harry Potter, any of these great myths, Dune. They're all about choices, crossroads, structures, and how even good people can go bad if they're not careful. And elves can become orcs, you know. And It's interesting that Jadis in Chronicles of Narnia, what defines her is faster, faster, which Lewis knew what he was up to. I mean, being a medieval Renaissance scholar at Oxford and in Cambridge, he knew that a lot of the modern world was, in fact, demonic. It was Jadis-like, faster, faster, faster. We don't know how to slow down. So Jadis typifies that. And as a medieval Renaissance scholar, he understood the classical tradition was about the contemplative. But we've become like Jadises, you know, we have to go faster and faster. And then people shrink like little dwarves in that sense. They cease to be human in any deep, significant, or meaningful sense. And so Peterson's work, and sadly so, you get two attitudes towards Peterson. One, you know, they genuflect to him. The man can say nothing wrong. And then the progressives demonize him no matter what he says is wrong. And you want to say, you know, what is the good he's contributing and what might be his blind spots? I mean, he obviously doesn't have the depth of a Thomas Merton, but there's a richness to Peterson, you know. And I think a thoughtful person wants to say, what's the wheat and the chaff, the gold and the dross, as we do with anyone? What is he speaking to me that evokes depth? What is he saying? Perhaps it is reactionary and just not helpful. So that's a little book I did. And then another book I had two essays in. It's called Peterson Critical Responses. It just came out this year from Arizona. Yeah, it's Sandra Bowen, a friend of mine. She edited. The first one was on Peterson, and then one on Sam Harris will be out in a couple of weeks. And then she's doing a series of books. But if you ever get, it's called Jordan Peterson Critical Responses. I have two articles in that. She'd contacted me after I did the edited book on Peterson from Lexham. It's become a bit of a bestseller. It's called an evergreen book. It just keeps selling and selling. And so it's rather nice to know people are finding it, you know, minimally helpful.
Oh, I thought it was very helpful. It was a very interesting book. What I find so fascinating about Peterson is the actual phenomenon itself. He speaks to me, but I've been reading Joseph Campbell for a long time, and he kind of speaks my language. And I like Robert Bly, but Peterson, the phenomenon itself is so interesting because it's like, what is he saying that has ignited the hearts of it feels like the world? I mean, it's like, how unlikely is this guy to be speaking about what I would have assumed to be this niche thing, but somehow he has touched a nerve with a lot of people.
Yeah, if he stayed in the Robert Bly Campbell mythic tradition, he would be considered fairly harmless and he would appeal to the progressives or the liberal trendy progressives. What he's dared to do that Bly or Campbell and other myth people didn't, even Carl Jung, he's entered the political culture wars in terms of saying that progressives have no clothes on and that liberalism can be as fundamentalist as fundamentalist conservatism. Mm-hmm. You know, and liberals like to fancy themselves as about multiculturalism and pluralism and diversity and all these cliche creed words of sort of orthodox liberalism. But then when it gets questioned, they begin to become very defensive and they turn on anyone who asks questions of them. It's, you know, it's not very liberal of a liberal not to critique liberalism, but many liberals don't do so. And in that sense, they're no different from conservative fundamentalism that does not engage in self-criticism. And so Peterson has dared to say, you progressives, you critique fundamentalism, but you're fundamentalists too, because you're not self-critical. Critical thinking is a sword that swings both ways. So he's entered the culture wars, the political, social culture wars, in a rather animated way, in which, say, a Campbell or a Bly or a Carl Jung have never done. They've stood above the fray a little more. Peterson has entered the fray, in which you get this polarization between conservatism and progressivism. And he's obviously a little more on the side of conservatives, but he's certainly no uncritical fan of conservatism either. He's opposed to herdism. And you can get herdism on the right, you can get herdism on the left. And he's very, very much Peterson in that sense. The article I did on him for Sanders' book that just came out this year, he's very much a critical individualist. So herds of the right or the left, ideologically, he opposes, and he holds high the importance of the individual critically thinking about themselves and the world they live in. So he can offend both sides, because his underlying premises are the responsibility of an individual to think critically about the time, the place, the culture they live in. But he's tended to offend the progressives a little more than the conservatives, and they've been very vicious. And the cruder people on the progressive side have said very unkind, ungracious things about, which says a lot about them as people, you know, when their ideology is questioned.
Mm-hmm. What I love about him is he seems to have ignited something. And, you know, we're talking about these seekers, whether it be somebody like Merton or Kerouac. But what I love about him is he seems to have directed the seekers much more to the Western Christian worldview, in a way that I don't think the church really has. The church, I don't know why that is, but he seems to have funneled the interest of these people that have kind of hit the bottom of postmodernism and this modern world. And they say, well, this doesn't seem to be working. I'm not happy. You know, I've kind of tasted a little bit of everything, and this stinks. And so he's like, well, have you looked backwards? Have you looked at Jesus? Have you looked at God? Which is interesting to me, because I think historically that you see the seeker be attracted to the Eastern mindset much more than the Western. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think what's happened is many in the West have failed to understand what the contemplative tradition of the West has to offer in a thoughtful, insightful way. And so then people who are spiritually on a quest, they then turn to the East, various forms of Eastern traditions. Peterson will say, it's all in the West. Why do you have to go? He's not against turning to the East. He just says there's a mother load beneath your feet in Christianity. Sadly, so significant forms of Christianity have ignored that mother load, or they've denied that it exists, or it's demonic, or it's Eastern. I've a variety of students who get very interested in the contemplative and centering prayer and meditation and spirituality, and then they're told, well, that has nothing to do with Christianity. And you always say, well, what form of Christianity are you coming from that would say that, because it's actually at the center of Christianity. It has imploded since the Reformation in various forms of whether it's Calvinism or Lutheranism or Mennonite or Ypres or Pentecostal traditions. They've tended to very much marginalize, ignore that tradition, where someone like Peterson says, listen, the Western tradition has it. We've tended to forget. I mean, I teach courses in, you know, classical thought up to Erasmus, and then Erasmus up to Nietzsche and Heidegger. I mean, I've spent time at Nietzsche's home and Heidegger's home. I've scholar in residence in places like this in Germany and Switzerland. Hermann Hesse, I've spent time scholarly work in his area. Is that you have these, this, I mean, like Martin Heidegger, great German thinker, again, his longing to get beyond a crude rationalism, because too often Christianity has been defined by getting your creeds, your confessions exact. And if you don't get it right, then you're not, you're a heretic or you're heterodox. And it ignores the fact that there's depths to Christianity that only myth can present. And myth is the great teller of eternal truths. And it's not, ticking off whether you've got the confession, the creed, or the right read of the Bible exactly right that can be verified through archaeological or scientific means. That doesn't touch a person deep down. And so people like Peterson are coming along and saying, listen, there's alternate ways of reading the Bible here that are not either simply devotional and you don't ask critical questions, or like the new atheists that say, oh, the Bible's about violence and brutality and God commanding the Jews to wipe out people. For Peterson, it's no, you're missing the very means of how to read the text, which the history of the Christian tradition said there's always six levels of reading any text. So why are we stuck on this literal, grammatical, historical approach when the historic church has said there's six levels and the highest is the contemplative? And so Peterson is reintroducing people to a mythic psychological read of the text, which is a very healthy, and it's very deeply Christian. He doesn't go as far as the contemplative approach because he's a psychologist interested in counseling. He's just saying, look at these mythic stories. It's like the Cain and Abel, Cain is the driven person, the person who performs, has to accomplish, gets the barns built, and Abel's the contemplative. And so what does Cain do? Cain kills Abel. The activist kills the contemplative. It's the same Mary Martha story in the Bible, Jesus says, who's choosing the better part? It's the contemplative. And so Peterson will pick up these stories and say, listen, they're as relevant today as they were then in terms of myths, the active driven part, the Cain in us that can silence and kill the Abel in us. So we both have Cain and Abel in us. Everything hinges on what part of us we're going to listen to. And if we allow Cain to kill Abel, then we shrink as a human being. And then the mark of Cain is on us. And then where does Seth, as it were, a very important myth, fit into this? So Genesis, it's a Greek word, genesis. It just means the beginning of all myths, the foundation of all great myths. And then Exodus, exodos, is just the way out of your ego. So it can be read literally, the Jews fleeing Egypt, or it can be read as each person leaving the Egypt of the ego. And then in the desert, you have to let go of everything, because all those ways we defined ourselves in the desert, there's nothing there anymore. And then the promised land. So many of the church fathers and mothers interpreted these stories from the Greek tradition in an allegorical manner that applied to the self and the self in the life of community and in the public square. So Peterson, his exegetical approach very much draws from an older Christian approach to how the text is to be read, applied, internalized in terms of identity.
Do you have anybody that you would suggest people read that come from that same approach as Peterson?
Oh, there's loads of people. There's a huge revival today, these days, in these layered ways of reading, obviously, the Bible in a sixfold way. Henri de Lubac, Merton himself, you read some of his works on exegesis, reading the Psalms, or any of these works. He's a Catholic monk. He understood layered ways of reading. He was a literary person. So how do you read texts in an allegorical, typological, tropological, literal, grammatical, mystical, ecclesio way? So I could recommend loads of books of women and men who have gone to places Peterson hasn't even gone with his psychological mythic read, but any of the great Catholic mystics, Anglican mystics, Orthodox mystics, Protestants are slowly recovering what they have lost by interpreting Christianity in a very narrow, almost tomb-like way. And thoughtful people coming out of Protestant Christianity, they realize their soul is suffocating. They long for greater space for the wings of their soul to fly. And so this is why there's this great turn back to the classical form of Christianity, Roman Catholic, Anglican, and in your case would be Episcopal, Orthodox, because these traditions are all grounded in a contemplative heritage. And so Peterson is pointing in a direction. I did a couple of podcasts you can look up on YouTube, I think three or four on Peterson, and the difference between mystical and mythical reads of the Bible. Done probably 3 or 4 years ago, just as one of my former students launched Jordan Peterson. I don't know if you've heard of Lauren Southern.
Oh, yeah.
She was.
I watched one of your interviews with Lauren.
Yeah. So Lauren's a sweet soul. She was a student of mine.
Okay.
And Lauren just lives out here just across the water. And so it was she who launched Peterson at 216. She worked for Rebel Media in Toronto, and Peterson was at University of Toronto at the time. And so... yeah, Lauren did an interview, and she wants to do another one. Every time she comes across the water, we do a long sit, have a nice coffee together. She's there's two sides to her. There's this sort of the diva of the right, but then there's the deeper Lauren, who's really, she's done courses with me on the contemplative way, and I think Lauren's future, if she listens to this deeper part, she has a lot of potential. She also, have you ever heard of a person called Destiny?
The gamer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he did a long, Lauren said, she's been in touch with him. She asked if I would be willing to do an interview with him. So I did something with him a few months ago, too.
Really?
Yes. He's,
is it out yet?
Yeah. If you just bring up Destiny and my name, you'll see it. And so, I mean, these are people that are, you know, in their own way, they've been taken in by a lot of the state-of-the-art fly-to-the-moon technology, and they recognize it only speaks to a very shallow part of who they are, and they're all recognizing they long for depths and meaningful relationships, and they're good people deep down, and they're trying to find their way home, home to the soul, and that's a journey. It's not an easy journey when we have so many... T.S. Eliot talks about in four quartets being distracted by distraction through distractions. And it's how we get beyond those multiple distractions that the ego is attached to our true home, which is a place of deeper rest to which the contemplative, you know, draws us, evokes within us, summons within us.
So I actually agree with you that I think where Peterson... doesn't drop the ball, where his ideas kind of end is he has this interesting way of interpreting the Bible. It gets people interested, but historically he has kind of shied away from saying, I believe this. He believes it to be true, but he would never say if he believed in God or Jesus. And I think he has said that he believes in Jesus now, but how do you get people from the interest into the contemplative? How do you get them? How do you get somebody into something transcendent where they can feel God in their life?
Well, it's encourage them to be in touch with their deepest longings, to walk them experientially when they find themselves attempting to be still, facing into the demon within that won't be still. That has to be active, whether it's the monkey in the mind that leaps all around the tree of the soul, can't be still. It's like, okay, there's some hard work to be done here internally. And so the experience of facing into what we are not, so we can limp from who we deeply are in what called the image and likeness of God, that's a journey. It's a lifelong journey. And this is why my book on the Beatitudes in Greek, that it's not, there's two tenses in Greek, the aorist, in which you've done something, it's over. And then there's present continuous. All of those little aphorisms that Jesus is talking about in the Beatitudes, they're all in the present continuous tense. And the first, the attitude is dying to what we're not. And then you move along step by step into reshaping, reforming who we're meant to be as true image bearers, in which we're truly free now. We're no more enslaved in the little cage of the ego. So a lot of that formation process is, first of all, who's your spiritual mother or father, your Amma or Abba, that you know, a person sits with regularly. It's a communal journey, as Burton understood this. I don't think Peterson yet fully understands it, but he's inching in that direction. Kerouac never understood it, hence his tragic end. Merton understood it, and all the great traditions of Christian contemplation, it's always done in the context of community, in which the people we trust is we have to face those hard things, those drivenness, those painful experiences of transformation, deaths, multiple deaths, and multiple resurrections. That's what the Beatitudes, I mean, the Beatitudes are the Magna Carta of our new being in Christ and in the life of the church. And so sometimes they've been translated and articulated in a rather thin, silly way, and I've tried in my little book. I mean, the Beatitudes, the Beats loved it. I mean, beat down, Beatitude, you know, they're all, the Beats were keenly aware that at the ground of what they were doing was the Beatitude, beatific vision. They're all central to the Beat movement of the Beatitudes and being beat down only so that we will understand beatific vision. But the experience of knowing God is also an experience of many deaths, of much letting go. And if people don't want to go, if they want to live like that little seed of the grape or that little skin of wheat, then they're never going to know God, because we only know God by dying to what we are not, so we may live as our new being in God. And that's, I mean, this is why at the center of Christianity is a cross. You know, you die, but then you resurrect. And so the great myth or truth of Christianity is, we're only free when we die to the demands of the ego, and then we resurrect in terms of what's really there. So it's a death. Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about cheap grace and costly grace. Well, the great journey of transformation is one of costly grace, death, 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 resurrection, resurrection, phoenix-like. And all great myths have the death resurrection. You get Gandalf, Lord of the Rings, has to die to the gray to become the white. He has to face the Balrog. Harry has to die to resurrect. All great myths have that death resurrection. It can be done in nature. It can be done in any of our journeys. So the experience of knowing God hinges on, are we ready to die? If we're not ready to die, then we won't be able to hear the whispers, the invitations, the summons from the divine to our soul to become who we're meant to be and really come home again.
So it's almost like the duality of pain with transformation have to be linked. We have to have pain to have the transformation.
Yeah, this is why in Christian tradition, the fire is very important. The fire burns the dross off so the gold will be revealed. And fire is a very important image in Christian contemplation tradition. And so it's the wheat has to be separated from the chaff, the gold from the dross. So fire is very important. Now fire, it's like we have to be guardians of the fire, because fire can destroy, but it also can burn off what needs to be burned off. So the real gold of our true being emerges. But that, some people want to cling to the dross. They identify themselves with dross or with chaff. And Christianity, as in all great contemplative traditions, they all say, you know, the whole central issue is the very thing you cling to has to be burned. And only in that doing is a person free to be who they're meant to be, rather than enslaved in the little cage of their ego. But suffering hurts. So most of us naturally say, I'll avoid it as long and as far as I can without realizing, well, no, that's the very yellow brick road to becoming who you're meant to be, because the fire of the divine burns the ego. So the gold of our true image and likeness of God will be revealed, and we're truly free to be daughters and sons of God at that point. So, but sometimes that's interpreted in a very unhealthy way, that people have to die to themselves. What we die to is not our deeper self. We die to the ego so that our true self will be revealed. And so, but sometimes people misinterpret all that, feeling they have to repress even healthy elements of themselves, which is their true being in God. What dies is the false self, so that the gold, the wheat of the true self will emerge in that. But it is suffering, yes. There, it is struggle. People have to go to places that is not always comfortable. But it's in going to those places our true liberty emerges.
I imagine there's going to be people that listen to this and they say, I want that. I want what you're talking about. What would you tell them to do first?
I would say, look for women or men you trust as a wise person. Ask if you can meet with them regularly. I mean, if they're much further down the road in the journey, they're sensitive people, they're insightful people, they face their own demons. They've struggled with very important issues in their inner life as well as their outer life. Many of them probably have suffered. They've probably got tragic elements if you heard their stories. They're tender people. They're gracious people. Never do it alone. This is, I think, Kerouac's tragedy. It's Merton's strength, even though he struggled with it, is that find women or men. In the Christian tradition, they're called Ammas, wise women, or Abbas, wise men, who are further down the journey that can be trusted. They're not going to take advantage, you know, of a person's honesty, their vulnerability as they seek to become who they're meant to be. So I would say, first of all, a trusted wiser, woman or man on the trail. I would also say immerse yourself in a community in which, you know, person could be known.
Mm-hmm.
Because when anyone tries to do this alone, Kerouac is the metaphor of the cliff's edge. As much as, you know, I appreciated his work from On the Road, his lively little work. I mean, a lot of the work of Dharma Bums, which comes short, that's all done up here. Desolation Angels, that's all up here. You know, Dharma Bums was done from the big event in San Francisco that Kenneth Ruxroth chaired, and then Gary Snyder, Jaffe Ryder in Dharma Bums. This is all taking place up here, just down the road from where I live at Ross Lake. But then you get that uber individualism in Kerouac, and because he didn't trust anyone or was connected meaningfully, you get the tragedy and his drinking problem and his alcoholism and his early death. Whereas for Merton and others, they entrusted themselves to people who are wiser on the trail.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say read great works in the Christian tradition and other traditions of contemplative women and men. Yeah, allow them to speak to the soul, to invite the soul to depths, because we're desperately in need of deep people. There's lots of rational people who can parse arguments, play Thomas Aquinas games, the chess game of ideas. There's lots of uber activists. There's not a lot of deep people. And contemplatives, above all, are deep people. So there's the books, which are very important to know. So sit with these great contemplatives that have been around for thousands of years. Be with people who are living that today, and then be in communities. So these three things are very important. The great works of literature, of contemplatives, women and men, whether Catholic writers, you know, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, the Ignatian tradition, the great patristic writers of the East and West. Erasmus is the key figure, obviously Merton, Gregory of Nyssa, Nazianzen, you know, Jerome, Augustine, read Augustine's Confessions, for example, the story of a very honest person. Merton's Seven Story Mountain is excellent. So books are very important. A person always should have a good library of fine books of women and men who've thought deeply about the contemplative and their journey, and then living people. That's very important. So it's just not books, but people who embody that great story, the cloud of witnesses, communion of the saints, and then communities that one is faithfully knit together with. So I would say those three things are very, very important. Without that, then people are alone. And the contemplative life is never, no great contemplative would ever say this should be done alone. This is always done in the context of thousands of years of wisdom that is behind us, living people who embody it, and then communities that embody it. Because if we do it alone, people can end up saying and doing some rather bizarre, eccentric, and usually unhealthy things in the name of spirituality. And so I would say those three things are healthy criteria for a person on the search.
Would you mind, after we get off this call, would you send me like your top five and I can link it in the show notes just so people say this is where you want to start?
Oh, sure. Yes, I could do that.
That would be great.
There's so many. Yeah, there's so many books. There's thousands of books by wise women and men, you know, on the journey. And so Evelyn Underhill's little work, The Spiritual Life, is very, very good. A lovely little primer, great Anglican mystic. Her work, big work, Mysticism, broke through beginning of the 20th century, was considered the most significant work on recovering the contemplative mystical way. Brilliant woman. Thomas Merton, C.S. Lewis, some of C.S. Lewis's works are very insightful. Screwtape Letters, in terms of formation, all the little whisperings that can go on in us if we're not aware, and now if we're not attentive in that sense of Simon Vai, we're not attentive, we can very much be a plaything of very unhealthy internal suggestions.
Before I let you go, I have to ask, how did you get into the mountaineering?
Oh, you know, I was a terrible student in high school. And I would be bringing my teachers, I'd wanted to get their feedback on Plato and Aristotle and great Indian thinkers. I'd want their thoughts on Greek and Latin translations of important Western texts or Indian texts like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. And they would say, this has nothing to do with the curriculum. It's just to stay with the curriculum and then you'll get through high school. I said, I'm not interested in I'm interested in education.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we don't do education here. We have a curriculum. This is what's expected. And then if you write down what's expected, you pass and you can go on to, I said, that doesn't interest me. So I didn't do well I'd head off with my books, whether it's Lev Tolstoy's Lord and Peace or Dostoevsky, I'd be reading the great Russian and, you know, Indian classics and great works of literature, and I'd head off with my dog, a bottle of wine and a loaf of bread, and head out in nature. I spent a lot of time in the nature. In my early 20s, I then went to live in Europe, in Switzerland. And of course, the Alps are very big there. So I was taken very much by the Swiss climbing tradition, the Alpine tradition. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time up in some of the major peaks. And then I went and lived with the Sami up in northern Norway, or Laplanders. They're called the Mountain Laps. So mm-hmm. In my early 20s, I grew up in Ontario. And so there's lovely areas there, but they certainly don't have the rich mountains that Switzerland has or Norway. And then eventually learned a lot about mountaineering. And I, at one point, thought of... it takes 12 years to become a trained mountain guide in terms of all season, all terrain. And I was teaching mountaineering on the West Coast out here. I had a cabin I would take Outward Bound out. I helped open up the big caves here. They're the third biggest in the world. And so so this was in my early, mid-20s. And my wife said, you know, you can head off and become a certified mountain guide, but she said, your cabin way up here in the mountain is a library of thousands of books. She said, have you ever thought of going back to university or going to university? I said, well, you know, I'm a terrible student and I'm not very bright. And I failed high school many times because I left with a saying by Mark Twain, don't let school interfere with your education. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I don't think I'll do well at the university. And if you don't do well, then finish your training as a mountain guide up in Canada. Here we have some, our great Rockies up here, and this great schools of training for mountaineering. So I went to a semester and I, you know, I got straight A's and then A pluses next semester. And then I got offered a Rhodes Scholarship to study at Oxford. And she said, I think your vocation is probably the teaching and your A vocation is mountaineering. So I've done a variety of books on, say, mountaineering and the humanities and Thomas Merton and the Beats of the North Cascades. The Beatitudes is the metaphor of mountain valley. I use that metaphor a lot. So it's so I go back to my late teens, early 20s, and I've sort of lived. Also, I did a lot of, when I was young, skiing in Canada. We grew up in skates and skis. And so skis, I did a lot of freestyle skiing and trick skiing. And I live right near Whistler up here where they held the Olympics in 2010. Great mountain skiing. So mountain and mountaineering and all season life, it's just oxygen for the soul, you know, and the busyness and demands of life. Again, it's that contemplative. You get away to a high mountain hut, or you know, in terms of skiing, heading up for 10, 15 kilometers to a chalet up in the Rockies, and then spend 3 or 4 days with the fire crackling and the quietness of it, the stillness, skiing under a full moon all night or something. This is just so good for the soul. It just gets you away from the demands, and you just slow down, you be still, and recover your sanity. And that still point in the moving world. So it's so foundational to who I am is the mountains and spirituality, the mountains, contemplation. This is why my book in the Beatitudes, When Mountain Meets Valley, Merton wrote a lot about, he used the mountain as a metaphor. Again and again, I did a series of articles on Merton and the mountains. Some of the greatest contemplatives have always, the mountain has been the dominant metaphor of the mountain valley. Mountain is a place of stillness, silence, solitude, quietness. And then we have to think about, so my life in the valley, what's it been love? Where do I need resets, course corrections, thinking a little deeper. So when I come back down, I'm a little more centered again. So I always live in the tension of mountain, valley, valley, mountain. It's very important for my own health and sanity.
Well, I'm envious. We wear flip-flops on Christmas here. So it's about 90 degrees most of the year. Oh. So. Well, Ron, I appreciate you. I think what you're doing is really important, and I think it's helpful for people like me that, you know, I look to people like you for guidance. So I appreciate you, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, well, I hope in some way it's been some minimally helpful and a little key in the ignition of which then you'll continue the journey and do interview better people than I, who are wiser, more insightful, have traveled further down the trail, that they'll be very kind and gracious with you as you're asking the big questions of the journey.
Shoot, I don't know about that. I think this is one of our better interviews, so I'm very pleased to have you on the show, and I appreciate you.
If you'd like to check out more of Ron's work, we're going to link to his book on Jordan Peterson, Myth and Meaning. And we're going to also link to his most recent book, The Beatitudes, When Mountain Meets Valley. We're also going to link his 5 most recommended books for cultivating a contemplative worldview. And as always, if you want to support this podcast, you can subscribe here, or you can go and check us out on Spotify or Apple Podcast, or you can go and download our mobile app, Hope, Mindfulness, and Prayer, which is available in the Apple and Google Play app stores. Thanks.